Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. David Lavery, Professor of English, is our guest today. He's the chronicler of all things Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as well as The Sopranos and Lost. He has organized international conferences on all three of those television programs. He is the author of more than 120 published essays, chapters, and reviews, and has had a hand in writing and or editing 23 published or under contract books, most of them about television. With Cynthia Burkhead of the University of North Alabama, he has co-edited the first volume in the University Press of Mississippi's Television Conversation series. It's called Joss Whedon Conversations, and it's a compilation of interviews with the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, and much more. Dr. Lavery, thanks for being with us today.
Happy to be here, Jenna. Okay.
Give us first an encapsulated Joss Whedon 101 lesson, a little basic background about the man and his work.
Let me see. He's the world's first third-generation television writer. Both his father and his grandfather wrote for TV. He didn't want to be 3G TV, as he claims he was kidded about when he was a teenager. Didn't want to be the third generation TV guy. Wanted to be a filmmaker. Went to Hollywood, wrote for Roseanne. Had run-ins with Roseanne Barr like everyone else did.
Oh, yeah.
And wrote for the original Parenthood, not the one that's on now. In his spare time, wrote a script for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It was made into a very bad movie. He was very discouraged. He wrote a whole bunch of... he did a whole bunch of script doctoring, where you know, for like $100,000, you're asked to rewrite a script, most famously Speed and Twister and Waterworld.
And co-wrote Toy Story.
He didn't co-write it, but he script doctored it, Toy Story, which had been closed down and Disney was ready to shut up and stop production.
That means script doctoring means he fixed what was messed up about it.
Right. For example, for any of your listeners who know Toy Story, the incredibly shy, low self-esteem Tyrannosaurus is Joss Whedon's creation.
Oh, okay.
If you look at something like Speed, he wrote every word of the script for Speed, but didn't get any screen credit for it. He just took his paycheck and went home. And then while doing this for a while, not a bad living, somebody got the idea to bring Buffy back to television. He said he would do it if he had the opportunity to run the show. He did. 144 episodes later, it had become a legendary, although not terribly popular in ratings, television series. He went on to make Angel. He went on to make Firefly. Firefly was summarily canceled, made into a movie, the first movie he had ever directed. He wrote comic books in the meantime. He couldn't feed his family by writing comic books. He dreamt still of being a filmmaker, ended up making Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, which was a web-only broadcast originally for free and then sold on iTunes, which was named Best Television Show of the Year in like 30 different venues, even though it never aired on television. Pretty successful television show for not even being a television show. And then in the biggest news of all, Dollhouse was canceled, of course, after 2 years. He finally got his chance to make a really, really, really big movie and is currently directing The Avengers, which will be the one that brings together Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, and the Hulk.
These are all the comic book
Marvel
characters.
Comics.
This is not the Avengers, John Steed and him appeal from the TV.
No, this is not the John Steed. That's true. This is the Avengers, which is referenced frequently in Buffy. Joss Whedon grew up as a Marvel boy, which is only natural because he's incredibly neurotic, and anybody reads Marvel comics is neurotic. I'm saying that because I read DC comics and I'm not neurotic. But he had turned down the chance to make Iron Man a few years ago. It was, of course, a huge success. He regretted that because he chose to do Wonder Woman, which was a DC project, which never would have worked for him. I could have told him. Mm-hmm. Others could have told him. But he thought it was the right choice. The movie never got made. He backed out. It still has not been made. Even the recent television reboot was canceled before it even got in the air. But he beat out Jon Favreau, the director of Iron Man 1 and 2. I understand Favreau was very angry, but he got the chance. He got the assignment to do the Avengers, mm-hmm. which means that having previously never worked with television, worked only with television budgets and on Serenity, the one movie with a $40 million budget, he's now up in the $200 million budget range. Mm-hmm. Well, so this is going to be make or break. If this is a huge success, we will probably never see Joss Whedon on television again. if it's a huge failure, he will probably come limping back to TV, okay. which I hope he does, frankly. So.
I'm sure you've answered this question many times, but what makes Buffy the Vampire Slayer, for which I think he's probably best known, more than any other project he's ever been involved with, worthy of serious intellectual pedagogical discourse?
Well, you're right. I have been asked that many, many times, and it's still a great question. My usual pat, a little bit too glib answer is that it makes academics feel like their education wasn't for nothing. when we watch Buffy, we find so much to write about, to think about. You reminded me that you interviewed me back when we did the Buffy conference in Nashville, the first Buffy conference in 2004. The fifth one will take place in 2012 mm-hmm. in Vancouver.
And this does attract academics from all over.
All over the world. I gave the keynote address, I just love saying this, forgive me. I gave the keynote address at a Buffy conference in Istanbul, Turkey.
Wow.
Of course, I was living in London at the time, so it was a little easier to get me over there. But it will go down as one of the highlights of my life. I never thought I would be talking about Buffy in Istanbul. And of course, Istanbul actually figures in the series at the beginning of season 7, but we won't get into that. You mentioned earlier that I've done, I organized conferences on Lost and on The Sopranos. And The Sopranos, for example, has inspired, I think, 8-9 books. There are now over 30 books on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and including a book-length bibliography mm-hmm. on work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There is no comparison between the academic scholarly interest in Buffy and any other television series. In fact, it's pretty much in comparison to any other visual medium that you care to mention. I can't even think of a movie that has inspired that much work. It is comparable to in television studies to what happens when you walk down the aisle in our library or any library and look at all the books on Shakespeare. Granted, they've had several hundred more years mm-hmm. to do the books on Shakespeare, but Buffy stands alone in that regard.
You're talking strictly about entertainment series or in everything that's been on TV from live TV to journalism to everything? Are you talking strictly about primetime entertainment shows?
I'm primarily, I guess, talking about primetime entertainment shows, but those would be the ones that, of course, have acquired the most interest, have gotten the most interest. And don't forget, too, this is a new field. I mean, mm-hmm. When I did my book on Twin Peaks in 1993, everybody said, you can do this. I mean, you can do a serious study of a television show that's been canceled.
Well, it does behoove us to examine a medium that has had so much impact on all of our lives.
Absolutely, Jenna. It's sort of flabbergasting. As some of your listeners know, I taught television in London for 2 years. And it is striking how much more the rest of the world accepts the serious study of television than we do. I mean, I remember Wim Wenders in his film Tokyo Gas saying that the Japanese may make all the TVs, but the Americans make all the images that go on those TVs. And we are, of course, it's one of the few things we're still exporting. We still export a tremendous amount of television and popular culture. My British students knew every American television show I talked about. Mm-hmm. And yet, here in the country that is turning these things out, it's almost as if we don't take it seriously.
It's like like a Kleenex. You use it, and then you throw it away.
Yeah, and you throw it away. And of course, the advent of the DVD and the bringing to DVD of old shows that never used to be available at all has had a huge impact on how we study TV. I can remember when I was doing my doctoral dissertation in 1978 on film, finding it hard to get the Fellini's films. There was no television available. You could never have written about television. You had to go to the Museum of Film and Television in New York or Los Angeles. But now we can walk into I guess you can't walk into Blockbuster anymore. You can go on Amazon and get almost any television show that you want to study and line them up on your bookshelf in nice little sets. Believe me, I have a lot of them.
Or go on Hulu if you want to watch some of the oldies but goodies.
That's right. It's a terrible irony, as I keep bringing up to my classes, that television has never been more interesting, and yet we have no guarantee that television is even going to continue to exist. The chances are that 10 years from now, we won't even recognize the forms that what we are now calling television exist in. And coming back to Whedon, one of the interviews in the book, you may have noticed, is from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, where they interviewed him about Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog and the whole new possibilities of creating stories, narratives with almost no financial backing, and putting them on the internet and using it as a business model. Whedon jokes in the one interview that asking him about business is almost asking him to make balloon animals or something like that. He said he can't even find porn on the internet, but here he is now thought of as a guru of the internet, and he calls himself in one of the interviews in the book he would like to be the Roger Corman of the internet. Roger Corman being the guy who made all the little horrible cheapy Edgar Allan Poe films
and served as mentor to a score of brilliant directors.
Absolutely.
Jonathan Demme and Martin Scorsese and Ron Howard
studied Jack Nicholson and Boris Karloff and all these important people. And that was Whedon said that before he got the Avengers gig.
Okay.
He's probably much less interested in doing that now.
Okay, so what makes Whedon's approach to writing for television different from other TV writers?
When you watch a long-running series now, it is almost impossible not to feel his influence. It's not as if he totally invented it. It had been done before. But the idea that people would change over the course of a series, and remember that television has opportunities for narrative complexity that are really unprecedented. Dickens didn't have it this good as far as being able to lay out a character's psychological development in real time.
He makes his characters grow and expand and evolve just the way human beings do in real life.
And die and all sorts of horrible things.
Or change and develop more nuances to their personalities. One might start out, maybe shrill and soften over time with life experiences, or just the opposite.
Absolutely. Right.
For example.
And every single major character who made it through Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you could say precisely that about. He never got the opportunity with Firefly because it was canceled after only about 14 episodes. But it is it's breathtaking to think about what that show might have become if he had the opportunity.
One of the interviews in the book, Whedon said so much of TV is just radio with faces. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I know exactly what he meant by it. He jokes that he took the gig to make Buffy the Vampire Slayer because he wanted to learn to direct. It's a mistaken notion that Whedon went to film school. Whedon did not go to film school. He did not, like Michael Bay's not the right example, not like Spike Lee or Robert Zemeckis or people like that. He didn't come out knowing how to direct. He came out knowing how to write. He came out with a film studies major's knowledge of the movies. But he took the assignment to bring Buffy back to television because he knew he would have the opportunity as the showrunner to direct anytime he wanted to and to teach himself how to direct. Mm-hmm. It was his impression, coming back to your question, it was his impression that most television really doesn't actualize all of its potential, its visual potential. It's radio with faces. There's reasons for that. The budgets are very, very low. Mm-hmm. A typical hour of television, really 43 minutes, is shot in 8 days.
Yeah.
I like to point out that Stanley Kubrick in 40 years made 14 movies, averaging give it 3 hours per movie. That's about 40 hours mm-hmm. of film that Kubrick turned out. In 7 years, Whedon and company turned out 144 episodes, which comes out right around 98 hours of narrative. And Whedon, because he had the privilege, because he was the showrunner, because he was in charge, gave himself assignments where he could cut loose as a director. As a result, we get Hush, an episode that is over half completely silent. We get the episode The Body, where Buffy's mother dies, and we get this lovingly shot and unbelievably moving reckoning with death and the nature of death. Not supernatural death, but ordinary death.
So what he's doing is taking, you know, the medium and kneading it like dough, like somebody, like, say, Ernie Kovacs used to do back in the primitive days of TV. He's reshaping the medium in different ways.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that that a complete set of Ernie Kovacs was just released on DVD. And I haven't seen it yet, but the reviewer said that a lot of it is pretty bad. But again, there's hours and hours and hours of just pure innovation. It was Whedon that made an all-dream episode of Buffy.
If you don't experiment with different things, how do you know what's good and what's bad?
That's right. That's right. And interestingly enough, he was not particularly a TV kid. He grew up with a PBS mother. His idea of television when he was growing up was Upstairs, Downstairs, or Masterpiece Theater, which he did a wonderful parody of in season 7 of Buffy. Mm-hmm. Masterpiece Theater, complete with the smoking jacket and the cigar and everything, the pipe, rather. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that he on his wonderful DVD commentaries, which we don't include in this book, somebody should collect those by themselves, but in his wonderful DVD commentaries, and he's I think the most brilliant DVD commentator ever, and he's unbelievably funny, but he's constantly saying he's watching what he just made and going, I am such a hack. Oh my God, am I a hack? And it never seems like it, but he's still very hypercritical of himself. He pushed himself to his limits.
Okay, so since he's reshaping the medium in a lot of the episodes that he writes, is there a reason why he doesn't do more work on cable networks like HBO and Showtime, which many artists have praised to the skies as being the epitome of what they want in terms of creative freedom, complete hands-off, go anywhere you want, do anything you want?
The Sopranos, for example.
Yeah.
Well, several years ago, I was pushing this when his career seemed to be in trouble, frankly.
You were saying, why doesn't he do that?
Why doesn't he go to HBO? HBO, generally speaking, comes to you. They came to David Milch, who had always had a trouble with censorship on NYPD Blue and Hill Street Blues, mm-hmm. and the result we got was Deadwood, yeah. The most obscene show in the history of television.
It was because they're so popular, they're sitting in the catbird seat, and they can pick and choose.
Whedon didn't quite have that kind of reputation. He's not the sort of guy that they would normally that HBO would normally pick. But when you look at something like True Blood, where they took essentially a filmmaker, Alan Ball, American Beauty, and he wrote American Beauty, and offer him the chance, the typical HBO thing is, what would you like to make? What would you like to try? And I still wonder, and I don't know the answer. It's a great question. Mm-hmm. If they ever made the offer, if he turned them down, it would have seemed entirely natural. When he signed to do The Avengers, the word was that he was ready to work for FX, which is the Fox see, he's the one. This could have been one of the problems. He is under a multiple production deal with Fox. Mm-hmm. He can't just go anywhere. He signed for a lot of money.
Do you think he went with Fox initially because it was the youngest of the networks and he figured it would be more amenable to taking chances than the three more established networks?
When he went with WB, when, you mean?
That's right. Buffy was on the WB. I thought it was on Fox.
No,
you're
right. It was owned by Fox.
Yeah.
But it was on the WB.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And it was more the other way around. They were willing to take the risk because they needed to build their base. Mm-hmm. And when they essentially threw Buffy away, mm-hmm. which is what happened when they jumped to UPN, they would have terminated it. If UPN hadn't picked it up.
I know why I thought Buffy was on Fox, because reruns of Buffy after it was canceled went to FX.
Well, that's because they owned it.
Right.
Yeah, that's because
that's
they owned
right.
it. Right. But it's a great question. But notice that it became their flagship show. It was the show that made the WB's reputation. But the WB was willing to do that because they had no reputation.
Right.
And it was the thing, this is well known among my Buffy friends, I did not start watching Buffy until season 4 because I hated the movie and it was on the WB. I'm going, what? I should watch this show? And MTSU students walked into my class the fall premiere day of season 4 and said, Dr. Lapp, are you watching Buffy tonight? And I went, are you kidding me? And it's those three people who were thanked in the book that got me to watch Buffy. And my life wouldn't have been the same. I wouldn't have been in Istanbul.
Why didn't Angel last as long as Buffy did?
It was canceled.
Well, I know that.
Yeah. It was way darker, less accessible, more adult. It didn't have that avid teen fan base.
There's no
Buffy
wry
had.
Humor on that show.
Oh, it was classic Whedon stuff, yeah. Although his involvement in Angel was much more limited than it ever was in Buffy. It was part of that period where he overstretched himself. Mm. He was in danger of becoming David Kelly. But no one would ever want to do that.
David E. Kelly of Boston Public, Boston Legal, Ally McBeal.
At one time he was doing, four shows and writing all of them?
Yeah.
All of every episode?
Yeah.
And he was going to do Wonder Woman.
And this is the man who's married to Michelle Pfeiffer. How do you ignore Michelle Pfeiffer and go to
I'm glad you said that, not me. So.
Anyway, one of the interviews in this book is called Joss Whedon Feminist. Is it a characteristic of his work that it has strong female characters in it?
Yeah, that's that wonderful interview from the James Longworth book of interviews with television creators. And it's still a much debated point. There are feminists out there who still don't give Whedon the time of day. Who think that his shows are too sexy, that Buffy fights in a halter top and, you know, a prom gown and things like that, and that she isn't what some people think of as the image of a feminist. On the other hand, I recommend that all those people go online and find the Equality Now speech that Whedon gave, introduced by Meryl Streep. With the feminist organization Equality Now, where he pretends to answer 15 different press gathering questions, all of which are the same. Mm-hmm. Why do you make strong women? Why do you constantly create strong women? And his answer is always, why don't you? And you know, when I look back over this weird decade of Buffy that I've been involved with, you know, it is I could tell you 100 stories of students and fans who have come up to me and told me about how much women I'm talking about in particular, and how much Buffy had meant to them, how much Buffy had given them strength.
It seems like almost every one who has had an impact on reshaping the television medium over the years from its inception up to today has had to battle network executives and network censors over creative issues.
Right.
Is that true of Whedon as well?
Yes. And of course it led in part to why Fox canceled him, why the WB let him go, but it was really Fox behind the scenes. One of the things, and it comes out very much in this book with the interviews, one of the things that I think Whedon, one, part of his legacy that you were asking about before, is that Whedon found an approach around the sensors and around the suits by being so clever that they didn't even know what he was doing.
As others have done, too, you know.
Absolutely. Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David on the Seinfeld DVDs talk constantly about how they used to game the refs, is what they call it.
Right.
In basketball, if you keep complaining the guy's defending you is holding you, then maybe one minute you will get the call.
Right.
In somewhat the similar way, Seinfeld used to toss up ideas to the network that they never intended to do and that they knew would never be accepted. And then they would toss up the one they really wanted to do, and the network would say, okay, you can do that.
Right.
And this, Whedon did a lot of that. He fought a lot for breakthroughs in many, many ways. But the subtleness of the innuendos on this show is beyond compare. I mean, I've given whole talks on this, the naughty Buffy. Joss Whedon has a filthy mind. I think that needs to be established. He has, and he admits this, he has perhaps the dirtiest mind of any film or television creator now working. I could give hundreds of examples, but we would be taken off the air.
Yeah, we'll spare the Federal Communications Commission the trouble. Let's talk about the series. You are the editor of this entire series, and there are going to be more books to come with more compilations of interviews with more TV creators in this series. Talk about where you're going with this.
Well, this is a series. In a way, it's a spinoff. it's a series at the University of Mississippi, the Conversations series, University of Mississippi Press, that has been going on for, I think, over 20 years. And it originally started with writers. They moved into filmmakers. They have they have book-length collections of interviews with everybody from Kubrick to the Coen brothers. And much less significant figures as well. And it occurred to me that because I was working on this Whedon book anyways, that I should pitch an idea of a television conversation series. And Lila Salisbury, the great new director of the University Press Mississippi, bought it and loved it. And it is, we're going to be doing at least two books a year for the future. We have another, for example, there's a book about ready to be wrapped up, a collection of interviews with Ken Burns that made the Civil War documentaries and all those other wonderful documentaries. We have books in the works on David Milch. We're certainly going to do one on David Simon, the Wire. And Treme.
David Milch, NYPD Blue, and what are some
Deadwood,
of his others? Deadwood.
And John from Cincinnati, and another one that's about to come out. Nobody would have bought this idea 10 years ago because nobody was talking about the people that make TV. TV was supposed to be basically anonymous medium.
This is surprising to me because there is an American Academy of Radio and Television. There is a Radio and TV Hall of Fame with all of the greats from yesteryear,
sure,
enshrined, Carl Reiner, Lucien Desi, all of those people.
I'm not talking about that. I mean,
some of these people are going to be in that Hall of Fame someday.
The industry has always recognized its greats.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very different thing than taking it seriously as an academic subject.
That, right.
And, of course, what we're really trying to do in these books, because we're bringing things from hither and yon. I mean, we have an article, we have an interview in this book from Crochet Me magazine, which is a wonderful interview about Joss Whedon's love of crocheting, which actually ends up in several of his works, like the crocheted hat that Jane wears in Firefly. But you would have to go one place to find that interview. You would have to go to another place to find the Wharton School of Business interview, mm-hmm, the Onion interview, the interviews that were on Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do in this book is bring them all together.
It's called Joss Whedon Conversations, the first in a series of television conversation books from the University Press of Mississippi. It's edited by Cynthia Burkhead of the University of North Alabama, which is in Florence, Alabama,
yes,
in the booming Quad Cities area,
yes,
and Dr. David Levery of the Department of English here at MTSU. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome, Jenna.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.